I hope, just by looking at some of these points, we recognize the pressure on us to be silent, but also the cost.
Dr. Albert Moeller, president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, making the case against Christian silence at the 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
That I am fairly certain that I will one day die. If the Lord returns before I die, then to God be the glory. But I expect that one day I will die. I want to die talking.
You can watch and listen to Dr. Moeller's teaching and all of the presentations from this year's conference for a tax-deductible donation of $300 by Labor Day. It's available via on-demand video streaming or podcast. Learn more at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.
Both Roe v. Wade and Obergefell contradict natural law. You'll never be on the wrong side of history when you're on the right side of natural law.
For a long time now, the church has been infected by the world to make a woman think that to be of value, she must basically become a man.
The dare that we can give is, I dare you to read this. I dare you. Because the Word of God is living, mighty, and active, sharper than a sword, and it's even living for people who are deniers and rejectors of it.
The one truth is that Jesus the Christ was born, died, and rose again from the dead for the salvation of men.
Utilization Review nurses love to listen to Issues Etc. while they work. Can I help you?
What were you taught about the Christian Crusades in school? Maybe you can't remember because you were taught hardly anything. So you turn on the History Channel and you maybe try and educate yourself about that particular era of Christian history, and you hear that the Christians were by and large the aggressors against a passive Ottoman Empire or earlier manifestations of Islamic aggression, and that the Christians were waging a religious war against Islam. Is that true? And what about the individual Christian crusaders themselves, often depicted as villains? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Friday afternoon, July the 29th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk with Raymond Ibrahim about Christian Crusaders. He's author of a new book, Defenders of the West, where he takes a second look at some of the leaders and the actors in the Christian Crusades. Then we'll wrap up this week's programming, looking forward to Sunday morning, according to the one-year lectionary, talking with Pastor David Peterson about Jesus feeding the 4,000 in Mark chapter 8. Raymond Ibrahim is a regular guest. He's distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute. He's fellow at the Middle East Forum and the David Horowitz Freedom Center, and he's author of several books, including his latest, Defenders of the West, The Christian Heroes Who Stood Against Islam. Raymond, welcome back.
Hello, Todd. Good to be with you again.
Why are so many of those who defended Christendom from Islam considered villains today?
Well, I think because most people are ignorant of history, intentionally so. And instead of being cognizant whatsoever about accurate history insofar as the Islamic world's interaction with the West, they're fed a false pseudo-history, which presents Muslims as sort of passive, peaceful, and then all the conflicts begin with the Crusades. And so if you speak to your average American and say, when do Muslims and Westerners start having problems historically, I bet you 9 times out of 10, they're going to say the Crusades. And the Crusades, of course, ostensibly appear to be Westerners or Christianers going on the offensive because, after all, they left their European homelands and traveled to the Holy Land, to Jerusalem, and fought with Muslims who had been there, again, in the popular imagining amongst most Americans for centuries or forever. I mean, most people, again, don't understand how Islam spread throughout what we call today the Middle East and North Africa. And because of that, I think, let me clarify that real quick. So in the 7th century, when Muhammad dies in the year 632, the traditional date given for his death, and that's when the Muslims, who are Arabians at this time in the Arabian Peninsula, really unify and then go on the jihad, as it's described. And they conquered all of North Africa, from Egypt in the east to Morocco in the west, and they conquered Southwest Asia, which we call the Middle East proper, which included the modern nations of Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Iraq. And then much later, centuries later, the Turks took Asia Minor and so forth. It's important to keep in mind that all those countries I mentioned used to be more Christian. Christianity permeated those countries more than in Europe in the 7th century. So that really was the heart of the Christian world. And you had five major Christian centers, which were Rome, of course, Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. And in the first century, four of those were gone and swallowed up by Islam. Now, that's the backdrop of what started hostilities between Christians and Muslims. It's that Muslims actually invaded and swallowed up and annexed most of the Christian world. And they took, of course, Spain in the year 711 is when they invaded it. And as I said later, the Turks took Asia Minor, went into the Balkans, and then the Tatars, who were Islamicized Mongols, actually the Golden Horde conquered Russia and also subjugated it along Islamic terms. So there's always been that long war, but unfortunately, it's presented in a vacuum. Just the Crusaders, these imperialist white racists, as they're portrayed today, just decided to go and ruin things and kill Muslims in the Holy Land. And again, that's out of context because a decade before that, the Turks were colonizing and destroying Asia Minor, and the Byzantine Emperor Alexius was the one who called on the Crusaders and the Pope to come to his aid. And literally, according to the sources, hundreds of thousands of Christians were being killed or enslaved, and thousands of churches were being desecrated. So that's the context of why the Crusades happened, but we're not told that. And so that's why I think when you talk about these men that I wrote in the book and Defenders of the West, immediately the popular perception is they're the bad guys, because we know historically it's Christians who start fights with Muslims, when of course the opposite is the truth. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, as a corrective.
So what else do many historians get fundamentally wrong about the Crusades?
Well, again, so for starters, the cause of it, it was actually two causes. Was one, to help fellow Christians, you know, their co-religionists in the East, as well as their own Christian kin, Western Europeans, who would go and do pilgrimage at the Holy Sepulchre or anywhere in the Holy Land, and they were being attacked in the years before the Crusades, and pillaged and raped and killed. And there's a lot of description of that, and some of it is in the book. So one was to help fellow Christians, and two was to, as they call it, liberate the Holy Sepulchre, which was this ancient church that was built by Constantine, believed to be over the site of Christ's abode. Well, it was a huge structure, and it actually covered where he was crucified, where he was buried and resurrected. And it was a massive complex, which actually was destroyed before the First Crusade, and it was rebuilt again, and then Muslims were attacking it again, and so it was a constant headache. So they felt they had to go and take over Jerusalem, basically to keep it as a safe, because technically it was considered the most sacred site in all of Christendom. So it was those two reasons, but historians just get it all wrong. And the main reason they get it wrong, I think, and is because they project our worldview and judge the past through it. And so, for example, what I just said about the Holy Sepulchre, most people don't even understand that, even if they are Christians, because modern-day Christians don't really have an appreciation for something like sacred sites or relics or that sort of thing, even though it was of immense importance, pre-modern Christians. But it's just, once you strip everything from, you know, you strip the religious aspect, as so many historians do, you're left with what seems to be a bunch of disgruntled, as they called them, second sons. So one theory for the longest time was that all these second sons in Europe who were dispossessed and had nothing to inherit because they were second sons actually decided to go on the Crusade because it was an adventure for them to go and become richer and find land and so forth. And that's absurd if you look at the reality, because most of them suffered so much. Most of them actually died. Most of them got nothing for their headaches except what would be called martyrdom. And most of them knew this was the case because it was a very arduous undertaking to travel thousands of miles, often on foot, through inhospitable terrain with enemies everywhere showering you with arrows and famine and, you know, lack of water and resources and so forth. So it was always a very dangerous endeavor, and most people just died, sometimes not even at the enemy's hands, just from nature. So that's not true. They did it because of their faith, and one can judge that as being misplaced or not. That's a whole different thing. But unfortunately, too many historians just anachronize, and they prioritize our way of thinking, and then they color those people of the past through those lens, and it's just a complete mess. And it ends up, like I said, with us seeing Christians and these early defenders or crusaders through a cynical lens, and we see them as just people trying to take advantage and attacking the other. And of course, we have all these new terms that we use, and again, further anachronize the past. We call them racists. We say they were part of the patriarchy, they're toxic masculinity. So all of these terms now, of course, apply to all of these heroes I discuss in the book, even though in their context and in objective reality, they're the complete opposite of all that.
So what was the state of affairs between Islamic and Christian lands when Godfrey of Bouillon came on the scene?
So Godfrey is the first hero I chronicle. He's chapter one. I have eight chapters, and I talk about eight different heroes and their times, and his name is shorthand for the first crusade that we're discussing, which Pope Urban called for in the year 1095 after getting all these terrible stories coming from the East and what was happening to Christians at the hands of the Turks, mainly the Seljuk Turks at this time. The First Crusade didn't have any official leader and didn't have any kings like other crusades. It was just mostly made up of lords and dukes and other magnates. And he was one of the major leaders. There were about four or five, depending on how you want to look at it. But he was definitely one of the major ones. And he came from what we would today call Belgium, even though it was described variously and differently. You know, it could either be seen as part of the German Empire or the Frankish Empire. He, of course, is called a Frank, just like all European Christian crusaders were in Arabic sources. And he and his brothers, Eustace and Baldwin, actually sold so much of their land. So they're a good example. They actually gave away much of their they were born actually very rich. They're aristocrats. Their father actually was at the Battle of Hastings with William the First of Normandy. And so they definitely had, you know, lots of land and properties and prestige. They sold much of it to fund their crusade and gave other lands away in the name of Christian charity. And then they took off, and they were among the first to reach. Well, first they all stopped in Constantinople, but then they traveled across the Bosphorus and reached Asia Minor. And he was one of the first to be there. And he's always, you know, his story is very prominent and, you know, it's very adventurous. I mean, at one point he attacked a bear that was chasing a fellow pilgrim in the woods. And it seriously mauled him and he almost died. And he was out of commission for a long time. But then he reappears again in the sources in a very valorous and heroic way. And he's always at the thick of the fights. And there's one anecdote where he supposedly splits a Turk in half with one sword stroke. But it's so heavily mentioned in the sources, and then even the people who write it say, yes, we saw it with our own eyes. They anticipate people will believe it. At any rate, he actually also ends up, I don't want to give too much away, I don't want to be a spoiler, but he ends up being the first king, essentially, of Jerusalem after he and the other first crusaders reconquer it and liberate it in their eyes from the Islamic tyranny that was going on in there. But he was very pious, according to the sources, and he would only take on the crown as long as he was not called a king, because he said, I will not wear a crown of gold in the city where my savior wore a crown of thorns. And so he took on the name, actually, Defender of the Holy Sepulchre instead of king, even though he effectively was king. And in many ways, he's considered he's like the chivalrous hero of the First Crusade. There's so many other names amongst the first leaders of the First Crusade. There's Bohemond, there's Raymond of Toulouse, and there's so many others who also play their part. But I chose him because even William of Tyre, the archbishop who wrote a chronicle, and who's a near contemporary, basically said we consider him to be the greatest amongst our first, you know, our leaders of that first generation of First Crusaders. So, yeah, and his story, you rarely get it because you have to piecemeal it together from various sources. There isn't one book written about him per se because there's so many other First Crusaders. But I think the first chapter is adequately done in a sense to give you a good idea of his life and adventures of the Holy Land.
We're talking about the Christian Crusaders with Raymond Ibrahim. He is author of The Defenders of the West, the Christian heroes who stood against Islam. We'll discuss Roderick Diaz of Vivar next.
In making its decisions, the government shouldn't do so with an eye toward helping one religious sect or another. It should be neutral, and it shouldn't muck about in the affairs of the religious realm.
Former Attorney General Bill Barr speaking at the 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
Their brand of secularism is really about destroying and subsuming the religious sphere altogether. And that's what I say. The threat today is not that religious people are out to establish a theocracy in the United States. It is that militant secularists are trying to establish an atheocracy.
You can watch and listen to a recording of Bill Barr making the case against the progressive assault on the U.S. Constitution from this year's Making the Case conference. It's available in both video and audio formats for a tax-deductible contribution of $300. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Making Disciples for Life. Across the nation, students are back in school in over 1,800 schools serving children in early childhood through high school. Students are thriving in programs of excellence in a safe, caring Christian environment taught by dedicated teachers. To find a school in your community, visit lcms.org/schools. Connect today for information about a Lutheran school for the children in your family at lcms.org/schools.
It's Ed Crusum's annual Christmas in July sale. From now until the end of July, every purchase over $25 will automatically be discounted at checkout by 25%. No need to remember pesky discount codes. We have Christmas ornaments, Christmons, posters, greeting cards, jewelry, church banners, and much more. To find out more, call us on 720-437-1104 or visit adcrusum.com. That's ADC. RUCEM.com.
Truth, freedom, and vocation are the pillars of a Concordia University Chicago education. Through them, we form our students for lives of influence and service for the common good. This is the education American society needs right now. I'm Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, and I invite you to visit us to discover what it means for truth, freedom, and vocation to become the pillars of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
Happy birthday to the U.S. Army Chaplain Corps, providing spiritual support since 1775. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces supports all Lutheran Church Missouri Synod chaplains who serve on active duty in the reserves, the National Guard, Civil Air Patrol, and the Coast Guard Auxiliary. Find out more about their work at lcms.org/armed forces, serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces, lcms.org/armed forces. We're talking about the Christian Crusaders with Raymond Ibrahim. He's author of several books, including his latest, Defenders of the West. So, Raymond, introduce us to Roderick Diaz of Vivar and explain how he encountered the forces of Islam.
So Roderick is actually a contemporary of Godfrey. He's a Castilian from Spain. And, you know, and this, again, underscores what I was saying earlier, which is that the jihad and the Islamic attacks were just so multi-tentacled. Because, again, when you think of the Middle Ages and you think of conflict, you think of the Crusades in the East and the Holy Land. But in fact, you had crusades going on in Spain, which is the furthest west from the Holy Land. So one is on the easternmost coast of the Mediterranean, one's on the westernmost coast. That's because, as I mentioned, the Muslims had invaded Islam, Spain in the 8th century and completely colonized it. And again, engaged in lots of atrocities, which are all mentioned in the book. And then Rodrigo or Rodriguez or Roderick of Vivar is actually better known as the Cid. So when you hear the movie, for example, Charlton Heston, El Cid, that's about that man, Roderick. I think till today he's considered Spain's national hero. And it's telling that he rose in the context of jihad and counter jihad, or basically Reconquista. So he's in the context of when the Spaniards were trying to reclaim and win back most of Spain, because after the initial Muslim conquest, most of the Christians who would not submit to Islamic rule were holed up in the northwest quadrant of Spain. It's an area called Asturias, a very mountainous and hospitable region. And from there, the Reconquista began, where the Christians tried to reclaim Spain slowly, piecemeal, as they spread further south from their mountain stronghold. And El Cid, Roderick Rodrigo, is a very pivotal character in the beginning of it. And he lives, like I said, he's contemporary with Godric, he's contemporary with the First Crusade. And he fights, really, what the best way to describe it is a jihadist ISIS-like group known as the Almoravids, who came from Africa. So now the Spaniards in Spain were actually reclaiming much of Spain from Islam. And the Muslims in Spain, who the sources call the Moors, called on their co-religionists, fellow Muslims from North Africa, to come to their aid. And they got this very militant, very jihadist organization known as the Almoravids, who are just like ISIS. In fact, they would wear pure black, cover everything but their eyes, you know, where it had a black flag that says the same thing, you know, no God but Allah, Muhammad is his prophet, and so forth. And they marched in and really devastated Spain in the first battle. They actually created a massive pyramid of heads from Christian Spaniards, something like 2,600 heads they chopped off on the battlefield, made a pyramid, and then had the muezzin go up on top and start calling Muslims to prayer as they desecrated the remains of their Christian foes on the floor and started screaming Allah Akbar and so forth. So that's the context where El Cid Rodrigo comes in, and he actually fights them back, and really amazing stories from his time, all of them from the primary sources. He actually had a monk follow him around and wrote a chronicle about his life. And also there's a famous poem of the Cid, which still today college students often encounter it in courses, which was written about him and also is near contemporary. And so a lot of very interesting, fascinating stories and adventures from the Cid. And again, you know, it's interesting because the stories in this book, in Defenders of the West, are such that they really give meaning to the phrase that fact is stranger than fiction. Because when you look at really what they went through, and then the stories are just the sort of thing that Hollywood should come up with. And if they did, you'd think it was fake, but it's really not. It's true. And just the severity of the battles and how long they lasted and how outnumbered the Cid often was, and yet he would always come back and prevail against this jihadist group, the Almoravids, you know, the medieval rendering of ISIS and so forth. It's, I think, just eye-opening when you see the reality of it.
Tell us about Richard I of England, Richard I.
Sure. So Richard the First, he's still known today. He's given us the moniker Lionheart or Lionhearted, because that's what he was known as, Richard the Lionheart. And so he spearheaded what's called the Third Crusade. So Godfrey was in the First Crusade. The Second Crusade is not much to talk about. It was very unsuccessful, except in Spain, because some of the crusaders from Europe who actually tried to go to the Holy Land during the Second Crusade went to Spain to help the Spaniards, and actually they triumphed very well against their Muslim foes there. But the Third Crusade was also, it features Saladin, the Muslim leader, and Richard. So they're the two main opposing forces. So Richard goes around the year 1190 or so is when he lands in Jerusalem, and his story is well recorded, again, by contemporary sources and chroniclers, as well as Muslims. And his story is just, it's just amazing. Again, I mean, you really understand why he got that name, Lionheart, when you see the great odds that he was constantly facing and how he would essentially almost single-handedly terrorize the Muslims. I mean, he's portrayed as something of a giant in the texts. And I think I discussed that a bit in some footnote, but I think they even exhumed some of his body, and he was apparently 6'4". Or something to that effect, for which is immensely tall for the time. But it's interesting because even the Muslims who were his enemies and suffered at his hands actually write down the same things that you would think are exaggerated exploits that Christians wrote just to magnify, you know, Richard's name. But they write the same thing and they validate it, just the way that he completely single-handedly would terrorize them. to the point that they all hid from him and would never want to encounter him, including Saladin, who before Richard entered the scene was really this triumphant sultan. But Richard managed to actually reclaim some of the gains that Saladin had made during the Third Crusade. So a very singular figure, Richard, and one reason why he's still famous still today, because when you read again the sources and you see what he did and what he went through, just it's very hard to appreciate with our modern day mentalities, and not to mention our comforts, and to see again, this man was a king actually. So he was the king of England and he had lots of land in France, and he gave it all up and went again in the name of piety and then in the name of reclaiming the Holy Land. So again, for a Christian cause, and he gave it all up and he went, and he really suffered a lot, including when he came back and he was imprisoned by a fellow Christian. And also he actually had to cut his crusade short because of the French King Philip, as well as his brother John. So this is where all the legends of Robin Hood and John in England and King Richard comes back. So that's where all that comes from. But yeah, he had a lot of difficulties from everyone, not just Muslims, but his own brother and fellow kings and so forth. And, you know, he made a very heroic stand against it all. It's very impressive.
Raymond Ibrahim is our guest, author of Defenders of the West. We're talking about Christian crusaders. Several of those crusaders were canonized by the church for their defense of the West and of Christendom. We'll talk about them, Ferdinand III and St. Louis, next.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Did you know that many LCMS military personnel and their families are unable to receive Word and Sacrament ministry due to the lack of LCMS chaplains? Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for pastors who will answer the call to serve as a chaplain to provide Word and Sacrament ministry to the men and women who selflessly serve our nation. Find out more about this exciting ministry by contacting me, Chaplain Craig Mueller, at lcmschaps@lcms.org. That is lcmschaps@lcms.org.
Memoria Press's award-winning Latin programs are designed to teach your student to master Latin grammar through an easy-to-use step-by-step process. By studying Latin, your student will gain an academic vocabulary, a mastery of English grammar, and develop sound critical thinking skills. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next purchase by using the coupon code LPR22. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time. MemoriaPress.com.
Please know that you are welcome at Ascension Lutheran Church in Niles.
We believe that every word of Holy Scripture is true. Jesus died and rose again for your salvation.
We pray for each other. It's a priority.
We help each other in times of need.
We help each other grow in faith.
We encourage one another.
We truly love one another.
We have room for you and those you love.
Ascension Lutheran Church.
Niles and Annoy.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Not only does our church need men right now, but the world needs men who will proclaim the gospel in its purity.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Peter Scher, Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
If when you go to sleep at night, you're thinking about it, my experience with it is this, is that thought won't go away. So if you're going to bed at night thinking about following our Lord and becoming a preacher of this gospel, then I would love if you could come and visit Fort Wayne, our campus. We'd love to show you around and show you what it is that we do.
Have you ever considered becoming a pastor? Contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155, or visit ctsfw.edu. Christ-centered, cross-focused, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Friday, July the 29th, we're talking about Christian Crusaders. Raymond Ibrahim is our guest, Distinguished Senior Fellow at the Gatestone Institute, Fellow at the Middle East Forum and the David Horowitz Freedom Center, and author of several books, including his latest, The Defenders of the West, The Christian Heroes Who Stood Against Islam. Who was Ferdinand III of Castile, and why was he in time canonized by the church for his defense of Christendom?
So Ferdinand, we jump now from El Cid, who was living in the 11th century. Yeah, he died, I think, right around 1099. He jumped now to the year 1200, about a little more than a century down the line. And the Reconquista continues going and fighting against Islamic hordes coming from Africa, North Africa, Berbers and such. And now in the year 1200, Ferdinand is born, also known as Fernando in the sources, depends on which rendering. I usually refer to him as Ferdinand. He's actually related to Rodrigo, El Cid. He's something like his fourth grandfather. And he becomes king of Castile. And from the start, he's so committed to the crusade in Spain, and not least because of his lineage. He has a lot of crusaders, amongst whom are El Cid. And actually, Richard was his granduncle by marriage. So a lot of these guys, it's interesting to see how interrelated they are, sometimes by marriage. But so he obviously grew up in a very crusader mentality. And as a youth, he was so committed to it, and he trained very hard at arms as a young man. And once he became king, he completely spearheaded the Reconquista. We can say he actually finalized it, because by 1248, he had really conquered all of Spain, central Spain. There were others, of course, such as James of Aragon to the east of Spain and Valencia and so forth, who were also engaged in the Reconquista. But he's really known for getting all the major cities. He liberated Cordoba, which, of course, was one of the greatest cities historically, and also Seville in 1248. And with that, all that was left was Granada at the southernmost tip of Spain as being an independent Muslim kingdom. And even it was a tributary to him. So it was a vassal state and had to pay him money. And of course, couldn't engage in jihad or any of that, or take slaves and any of that. So he really, in many ways, brought the Reconquista to an effective end in 1248. And a very pious man, again, according to the sources. So he became canonized as a saint. I think he's the only Spanish king in well over 1,000 years to get that honor. And his body is supposed to be, I've seen pictures as well, supposed to be uncorrupt. And it's visible in Seville, in the Cathedral of Seville, in some glass case, which is visited by pilgrims all throughout every year. And so that's one of the reasons that he's very famous and he's sainted to this day. He's considered a saint. And again, I find it ironic that this man, whom just ostensibly you think of as being a saint or a holy person, it's actually almost all of it is in the context of warring against Muslims, which again underscores how Spaniards and the Christians of Spain understood the conflict with Islam. You know, it was Muslims had stolen our land, had Islamized it, had destroyed churches and killed Christians and enslaved women and children. And we are righting that wrong and bringing Christ back to our original domains. So that's the thinking. And that's why a man such as Ferdinand III became a saint.
Another who carries that appellation of saint is Louis IX of France. Why did he go to war with Islam?
Right. And Louis, again, it's interesting because Louis is a first cousin of Ferdinand. And also his granduncle would be Richard I. And again, he was in the Holy Land during the time of Louis. He took another massive blow, and a new fanatical Muslim group had risen and attacked Jerusalem, which was then in Christian hands, massacred everyone, mass rapes and enslavement, women and children, and so forth. And a new crusade was called, and he was the only king who had actually come to the summons as the King of France. And he also went... His life is probably in many ways the most amazing, and it's very well chronicled. There's so many sources, a wealth of sources for his life. So that was good, and it allows one to really dig deep and bring in some interesting aspects of his crusade. But he went to the crusade, which was mostly centered in Egypt, and it didn't turn out too well for him. There were a lot of losses and setbacks and so forth. But I think that's what makes his character a very interesting character, because even in the face of adversity, including that he was a hostage in Egypt for a long time and very mistreated, that he kept his faith. And it's very interesting, even his contemporaries couldn't believe it, including religious orders and people, priests and monks and so forth. And anyway, you know, his story spans many decades, and he goes back to France and so forth. And then there's another attack on the Holy Land decades later, and he goes again on the crusade. And again, it doesn't really turn out the way he wants. And he actually ends up dying from plague, along with one or two of his sons, because his family would often go with him. It was a pilgrimage. And that's another thing to understand. Crusades were seen as pilgrimages. It was like a holy undertaking. And so sometimes women and children would even go in during the crusading, and that was often the case with Louis. But he too, for his pious lifestyle, which I discuss a bit in the book from the sources, very quickly became a saint. And I think he too is the only king of France to get that honor, to be a saint in well over 1,000 years, along with his cousin in Spain.
So what should we know about John Hunyadi's part in the crusade? Not a well-known name.
Right. So now after we've talked about, I think, 5 or so of the main heroes I discussed out of the 8, now we turn to the Balkans. And really the crusading era, as we know it, is mostly over. The Holy Land has finally been swallowed up by Islam again. And now the crusade has turned from being an offensive warfare whereby Europeans travel to the Holy Land and try to recover it, to being a defensive endeavor, because now you have the Turks invading Europe proper after they had conquered Asia Minor. Now they've actually entered, they got a toehold in the Balkans. I think the first place was Thrace or in Bulgaria. This is the context for John Hunyadi in the 15th century. He's born, I think, sometime late 1380 or 90, or maybe very early 1400s. I have the dates in the book. And basically, he was a governor from Transylvania and who worked for the Kingdom of Hungary and really rose up in its ranks. And he became he's a Hungarian hero today, even though some people will argue what his true ethnicity is. Some say he's actually more of a Romanian, which may be an anachronism. Others say he's Hungarian. Anyway, he was a voivode, or he was the warlord, really, of Transylvania, which was part of Hungary at this time. And he became a governor eventually, and he rose up in the ranks. And what was interesting about him is he really spearheaded all the counters against the Ottomans, and he would always be successful. So at a time when most of the Europeans were in a defensive position and really, you know, taking a defensive posture against any kind of Ottoman incursion from the Turks, he would actually argue the opposite and go in and attack Ottoman domains with outnumbered forces. And it actually worked. It was a sort of shock tactic that the Ottomans didn't know how to respond to. And it made him very popular in Europe or in Christendom. And he got many followers. And, you know, his story, again, is one of decades, not just one battle, that goes on back and forth with some are victories, some are defeats, and so forth. And it really all culminates at the Siege of Belgrade, which occurs around, I think, 1456. Again, the date's in the book. And he's an old man now, or definitely elderly for the time and sick, but he spearheads the defense of the Hungarian kingdom against Ottomans at a time when even the king of Hungary fled and ran at the advance of the Ottoman army because it was so massive. And Hunyadi, again, with a small force of men who were called the peasant crusaders, because all the great lords had fled or were just not cooperating, all the peasants just took up hammers and sickles, and none of them even had a proper sword. And they joined his forces, and miraculously, they actually defeat the much larger Ottomans and put them to retreat and run. In fact, that's the church bells of noon. When the church bells ring at noon, it was inaugurated to honor that victory against the Ottomans. And again, you know, few people, I would argue Protestants and Catholics, are even aware of the origins of this, why the church bells of noon ring. But here, once again, we see a major thing in Christian history that is once again rooted to Islamic jihad vis-a-vis Christendom. In this case, a defeat against the Islamic jihad and putting them to run at the hands of John Hunyadi.
Raymond Ibrahim, author of the new book, Defenders of the West, is our guest. Christian Crusaders is our topic. This is Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Folks, you have until Labor Day to order a video and audio recording of the 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. The speaking lineup consisted of Dr. Pavi Rossinen, Bill Barr, Pastor Will Whedon, Dr. Albert Moeller, Pastor Chris Rosebrough, Dr. Joel Bierman, and Pastor Brian Wolfmiller. We'll send you a link, username, and password for a tax-deductible contribution of $300 or more at issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8385. On the other side, we're going to talk about George Castriotti and why he has a nickname in Crusader history that links him to Alexander the Great.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Not everyone is comfortable with new technology. Dial-A Podcast gives all generations of your congregation an easy way to hear your sermons, or even devotionals and Bible studies. Once you've completed a simple one-time setup, we take care of the rest. All your congregants have to do is dial the number from any phone to listen to your latest podcast, all at no additional cost to them. Dial-A Podcast. Extend the reach of your sermons. Get started at dialapodcast.com now.
For nearly 140 years, the Lutheran Witness has taught the faith, defended it against error, and shown forth the great treasures of the Lutheran Church and biblical doctrine. We're continuing this legacy by publishing issues and articles that help you see the world from a Lutheran perspective and that teach biblical doctrine and show forth the treasures of God's Word. Visit our website to learn more and how to subscribe, witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Terry Mattingly is the eternal boomer. In other words, he, due to the circumstances of his birth, is lame.
Here's some feedback from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Terry can be counted on to deliver his boring, blasé takes in his irritatingly pseudo-profound fashion. Anyway, lame. May God have mercy on Terry. And Issues Etc. You're all a bunch of lame boomers.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about the Christian Crusaders with Raymond Ibrahim. He's authored several books, including his latest, Defenders of the West. Raymond, who was George Castriotti, and why does he bear the nickname Skanderbeg?
George Castriotti was, it's the Institute of Janissaries, the Ottoman Turks, other Muslim dynasties did as well, but they would they really perfected the art of enslaving young Christian subjects, in this case from the Balkans, and enslaving the strongest and most robust of their youth, males, and then sending them straight to military school where they would become Ottoman soldiers. And they would be trained in a very Spartan sort of atmosphere. And by the time they graduated, they would be really the greatest and most feared element of the Ottoman army, these Janissaries. And that's what George Kastrioti was, an Albanian. He was the son of a nobleman. And he was taken in, I think, at the age of 9. He and his brothers were taken from their father, and most of his brothers died or were killed by the Ottomans in their youth. But he grew up to be a really fearsome soldier and eventually became a general, and he was forcibly converted to Islam. And so they gave him the name Alexander because he was from Albania, which was, and it still is in ways, connected to Macedonia. So they thought of him as Alexander the Great, Alexander the First of Macedon. And that was the name they gave him. And Bey, or Beg in Turkish, means Lord. So Skender, or Skender Alexander, Beg, Skender Beg, meant Lord Alexander. So that was basically his name as an Ottoman Turk, as a Janissary. But he broke away all throughout these years. In his heart, he was still a Christian, and he was basically doing what he had to do to survive. As mentioned, his brothers were all killed. And when he got the chance, he actually escaped and renounced his Islamic upbringing, reclaimed his Christian heritage, went back to Albania, and really mustered the Albanians to resist the Ottomans. And very impressive. In many ways, he's probably the most impressive of all the heroes I document in Defenders of the West. And that's not my opinion. It's just that's been history's opinion. More has probably been written about him because he actually withstood the Turks he fought them for over a quarter of a century, or about 25 years, and beat them in every single battle, always vastly outnumbered. So he's known as the Albanian Braveheart, sort of a, you know, William Wallace of Scotland. He's a counterpart because he just lived for 25 years, just defying everything that the Ottomans sent towards him. And the sultans themselves would go there at the head of massive armies, and they would still lose, both because he was a great general, but he was also very brave and was able to harangue his men into action and inspire them. So his story is in many ways the most inspiring and impressive of all. And it's, I think his chapter might even be the longest because of that. And there's a lot of sources because he's also closer to us in time and space. You know, he's 15th century. So it's easier to find material on him than people like Godfrey from the 11th century.
Some might consider this final one unlikely. Vlad III, Dracula, why is he included among those who defended Christendom from Islam?
Sure. Vlad is included because, well, first and foremost, amongst the Romanians, or his descendants, he's a Wallachian. He's a hero because he actually, again, much like Hunyadi and Skander Beg, and he was a contemporary of both, he actually also defied the Islamic encroachments from the Ottomans, even though he had much to gain. He too was a captive in his youth of the Ottomans, basically a hostage. But when he finally made it back to his throne, he just resisted them and really terrorized them in ways. In fact, that's where so much of the scary, he is Dracula. The whole idea of Count Dracula comes from Vlad the Impaler, which is the Vlad we're discussing, Vlad III. And that's because he really perfected the art of impaling his enemies. And again, this is one of those things that most people aren't aware of, that he learned it. As I mentioned, he was a hostage of the Turks. He learned it from the Turks because it was the Turks who really perfected it and used it regularly. And basically, he was fighting fire with fire, essentially. But we don't get that. Again, it's brought in a vacuum, and we're not told that part about him. But that's why, really, he was doing it to terrify the Turks. But, I mean, there's also a lot of, and I discussed it in the book, there's a lot of exaggeration that comes from his time. Because during his time was the invention of the printing press, and it was used for propagandistic purposes by his enemies to make him look really worse than he was. Because, as I mentioned, other people impaled at the time and engage in all the sorts of violence that he did. And also the idea of him being Dracula comes from one particular episode where he really terrorized the Turks when they had invaded his country, because he, in the middle of the night, he came with a small group of men and they just did the unthinkable, which is actually raided the massive Ottoman camp as it was asleep. And he was searching for the Sultan. He wanted to decapitate him and basically cut the snake's head in order to kill it, because he couldn't fight the army in a proper conventional war. And much was written about that, and I duplicate a lot of it in the book. All of that is what created the legend of Dracula, the scary figure that travels in the night and massacres and kills and impales But again, once you strip all of that or understand it in context, in that he was fighting fire with fire against the Muslims, you understand why he is till this day considered a hero in Romania.
You say that without these defenders and many more like them, there would not have been a West to speak of today. What do you mean?
I mean that, again, we're dealing with a lot of historical ignorance and amnesia. And worse than that, I wish it was just a matter of Americans being ignorant. They're often fed a false pseudo-history, which is often the antithesis of real history. And so the long and short of it is the idea of the West, it wasn't some inevitable thing that just had to happen. Actually, it could have been snuffed out in many times and in many circumstances by many enemies. And for the longest time, the main enemy was Islam, because that's, as I mentioned earlier, Islam swallowed up most of the Christian world, and therefore it surrounded the rest of the Christian world. So if you look at, you know, Christendom used to be all of Europe, but also all of North Africa and all of Southwest Asia. But all of that was swallowed up, and the rest of it, Europe proper, was continuously bombarded by Muslim attacks for well over 1,000 years. And if there wasn't enough resistance, I have a nice quote from Teddy Roosevelt in the conclusion, and he basically validates what I'm saying. If the Christians of Europe could not resist and eventually actually overcome the Muslim attacks, the idea of the West and Western Europe would have been snuffed out. Europe would have suffered the same fate as Egypt and Iraq and Syria and all these other nations that were once great, but, you know, were swallowed up by Islam, and that was the end of them, essentially. We've even seen it. You know, Spain, that is Europe, that's the westernmost part of Europe, and that was under Islamic rule. So were the Balkans, and many of those countries are still suffering the repercussions of being under Ottoman control for centuries. So it wasn't inevitable that the West would emerge triumphant and spread around the world and so forth. It could have actually been snuffed out, and it was in certain areas and certain times. And again, if you think about it, a big chunk of it was completely swallowed, which was the North Africa and the Middle East. Again, you think of those countries, you don't think of them as being connected to the West in any way. You think of them as being part of the East, the Islamic world, the Arab world, and so forth. But that's only because of what happened. If you were living in the Mediterranean in the 5th century, the 4th century, or whatever, those would have been part of the Roman Empire, part of the Christian world. And it would have been normal to understand that, but they were completely severed, and the whole of Europe could have happened if it wasn't for stalwart defense by men such as those that I call defenders of the West.
Raymond Ibrahim is Distinguished Senior Fellow at the Gatestone Institute, Fellow at the Middle East Forum and the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He's author of several books, including his latest, Defenders of the West, The Christian Heroes Who Stood Against Islam. You can purchase this new book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Raymond, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
In hour two of Issues, Etc., we'll be looking forward to Sunday morning, according to the one-year lectionary. We'll be talking with Pastor David Peterson about Jesus feeding the 4,000 in Mark chapter 8. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
Do you want a church with a rockin' band and a sermon series to help you live a better life? It's not here. Bethany Evangelical Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights offers authentic, historic Christianity to a world awash in fads and entertainment, and offers forgiveness of sins to people overwhelmed with guilt and shame. Join us Sundays at 9:30 on Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights, Illinois, to receive the life-giving gifts of God with us. Find out more online at bethanylcms.org.
Bahama Mama, Ocean Pacific, Paradise Island. Retreat from the heat with a shaved ice snow cone from Tropical Snow in Caseyville, Illinois. It's right across the street from Collinsville High School. Tropical Snow is open weekdays from 1 to 9 and weekends from noon to 9. Premium snow, epic flavors, lots of love. Tropical Snow, across the street from Collinsville High School at 2134 South Morrison Avenue in Caseyville.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues Etc. Journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.